Welcome back, one and all, to another day in American news, as covered by the Damage Report with me, Johnny Rolla, and joining us once again, we were debating the title. I guess technically, contributor to Rebel HQ is the word. I'm gonna say like king of Rebel HQ, duke or earl. It's got to be something. Wow. I don't know.
But David, royalty. I'll take that anytime. I mean, people can whatever they want to say. If they want to say, you know, he's just Kingpin? Part of Rebel HQ, that's fine too.
Yeah, mogul. I don't know. We're gonna crack open a thesaurus and we're gonna figure this out together. But anyway, always glad to have you here. And I think we've got a pretty good rundown for us to chew some of the meat off these bones over the course of the next hour and a half or so.
Indeed. And you know what? We certainly look smart. So let's go for it.
We're trying. I dug through the back of my closet and found out, hey, wait, I used to own formal wear. I have shoes made of something other than canvas, it turns out. I'm not wearing them, to be clear. It's all shorts and flip-flops below the camera, but yeah, we did have this. So anyway, thank you everyone for being here. By the way, we do have a lot of news to get to. Some a little bit laughable, some incredibly serious, including some updates on the situation in Ukraine, which we're gonna be launching into in just a few minutes. How public, well, I guess private transit, but private mass transit, planes, trains, and those sorts of things will be going in the near future. Our lights are going haywire, so exciting all around. But anyway, if you wouldn't mind hitting the like button, if you're on a platform that allows for that, that'll let people know that we're live, which is great. And if you want to send us comments, tweets, super chats, all that, we'll respond as we go. But with all that said, David, are you ready to jump into some news?
Let's do it. Onward.
Let's do it. Let's have a little bit of sort of fun with this.
We hope that you and President Putin get together and can solve your problem. That would be a tremendous achievement. And I know you're trying to do that. President, we hope that you and President Putin get together and can solve your problem. That would be a tremendous achievement. And I know you're trying to do that.
That's just a little throwback to 2019. Like, it is obviously absurd now in the context of all that we know about what's going on with Russia's insane, barbaric, illegal war, the invasion of Ukraine. I just want to be clear, it was a crazy thing for Trump to say back in 2019. And the facial expression of Vladimir Zelensky, like, dude, do you know anything about what's going on in the world? You can see right there, that is everybody staring at our president, our country, the state of our society over those 4 years. Now, we have, of course, moved past the Trump presidency, and we've moved past the infantile idea that, like, just work it out with Putin or whatever. And as you're gonna see, we're launching into a absolutely massive movement of both Russian troops as well as armor in the east of Ukraine. We're gonna be giving you the details on that. But I just thought that throwback, David, like, put stuff in context that we had a president who cared so little and knew even less.
And I love also there's Zelensky trying so hard to kind of keep it together. I mean, you can see the gears going in his head and he's thinking, oh my God, what a moron. But he's trying not to be undiplomatic. He's just trying to, you know, kind of keep it together. poor guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's honestly, it's the sort of position that men like Trump have put a lot of women in, where they have to. They just have to be agreeable with them because unfortunately these people are equally awful and able to ruin their lives, their careers and all that. In the case of Vladimir Zelensky, the idea was you had to pretend that Trump was legitimate, knew what he was talking about, because Trump could just decide to not give you the aid that you need desperately. And remember, it wasn't long after this video that we found out that he was trying to blackmail Zelensky to get him to get involved in the 2020 election. So just, it's a confluence of so many amazing and now in hindsight, even more horrible things. But as I said, the invasion is continuing. The pulling back of Russian forces that they talked about turned out to be what we predicted. It was a brief regrouping and now the war is on. The siege of like places like Mariupol and a number of other places never stopped. But Zelensky announced just yesterday that the offensive in the Donbas region has begun. They say it's an assault on a scale not seen since World War II, which that might be true. Obviously, our invasion of Iraq was a large scale invasion, but that's how they're pitching it. He says a very significant part of the Russian army is now concentrated for that offensive. No matter how many servicemen get thrown there, we will fight, we will defend ourselves, we will do that every day. And you can see here a little map of the current territory that's being held by the Russians. Obviously significant, probably not what they would have predicted 50 some odd days ago. I think they would have thought that that entire map would have been orange at this point, David. But this is expected to be a more difficult period for the Ukrainians. It's going to be less focused on urban warfare, some of the sort of terrain that's made it a little bit easier for them to counter the large number of armored vehicles, tanks, things like that. Now it's a little bit more large and wide open territory where the Russians might have a bit more of an advantage.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a different kind of war now. And as you mentioned, the guerrilla tactics won't really work. It's far more open spaces. This is where the Russia's strategic numerical advantage could really come into play. But it's also worth remembering, this is an area that has seen a lot of shelling over the last several years. There have been skirmishes throughout the Donbass region for several years. So I'm not sure it's going to be the cakewalk that the Russians anticipate, because there's so much frustration already with them. However, it's certainly going to be very rough sledding for the Ukrainians as they try to figure out, okay, is it worth really trying to defend Donbass? Or is it at a certain point, do they just realize, no, Russia's going to be able to conquer Donbass and that's that?
Yeah, Zelensky had said over just the past few days that there's no peace that's going to be brokered by giving up eastern Ukraine. That said, it might not be up to him. And you say what you say, but the situation changes. That said, the predictions are that, you know, Russia is going to be more successful in this new phase. Bear in mind, I'm no more an expert on this situation than I was in the beginning, and the predictions have been largely wrong from the very beginning. So God only knows, that's why we're staying on this story and giving you updates, including updates like this. The Kremlin is dodging questions about what exactly happened to the crew of the Moskva. We covered that story late last week, and considering the fact that it had been being towed basically to port, that it had there were other ships in the area, my assumption that I stated on the show was, well, clearly they had the time to offload the crew. Well, they're acting as if there's something fishy going on. And in fact, family members of the missing crew are asking questions and receiving basically no information. They're publishing their account on social media saying, we're trying to find out what happened to our kids, and they're not receiving any confirmation. One mother said that her husband had asked a military commander where their son was, to which the commander replied, well, in the sea somewhere, which is, that's an odd way to put that. But anyway, they're not being clear. One would think whether the official story, which is that a fire spontaneously was ignited and then the ship just sunk into the ocean, whether that's true, or that the Neptune missiles fired by the Ukrainians sunk it, whichever of those is true, one would think the Russians would want to reassure their people that they had saved as many soldiers as possible. But thus far, they're being very like tight-fisted about the information.
Yeah, and either way, you can expect that there were at least some fatalities, right? Even if it's the Russia version of events, that there was a fire and an explosion, that's going to kill some of the 500 members of the crew. If it's a missile that sinks the ship rather quickly, then it could be more of them. I mean, there have been some reports that apparently only, 60 or 70 of the crew members have been accounted for, and the rest have not. And there have been some reporting that in Sevastopol, which was the Crimean base where the Moskva crew was essentially based, that the cars of some of the sailors were still there. And you would think that, well, if the crew had been able to actually get back to the port, they would take their cars and they would be able to drive away, but nobody had claimed the cars. So there's all sorts of rumors and speculation going back and forth. And the only thing we know for sure is that the Moskva itself is now part of the Russian submarine Navy, although not very operable.
Exactly. Yeah, I personally, like I've been saying from the very beginning, I hope that every one of them survived, and that I hope that they go back to Russia and end the invasion. That would be my hope. Of course, it's hardly up to us. Another interesting wrinkle of this. Let's jump into this video.
What kind of feeling would I have if some hostile military people were in my house? I would say fury and anger. However, this is not what I felt. I was surprised. I felt disgusted. I felt dirty, looking at some guys walking inside my house. So it was like an obvious decision. It's not about money. It's about efforts put into the house. I want to do everything possible to help Ukraine win.
Okay, this is fascinating. That is the Ukrainian military, Andrei Stavitsner, who apparently owns a large estate west of the capital, who had a camera inside of his house that let him know that Russians were there. So he contacted the Ukrainian military and asked them to bomb his own home to take out those who had been hiding in it. I'm gonna give you more of the details. He was talking in that video with Good Morning Britain. He said he'd abandoned the property relatively recently. Bear in mind, again, this is to the west of the capital. So despite the fact that most of the offensive is focused on the east, there are distributed troops in a number of different areas. So he says that they missed a webcam that he used to spy on them. He watched them store stolen goods in it, put vehicles outside and fire rockets from his property. And apparently his request to the military just might have been followed, because drone video shows massive damage to the property and what appears to be a military vehicle destroyed there. So it is possible that his webcam feed and his tip to them led to a strike that might have killed some of those soldiers. I've never seen anything like this in war before.
It's remarkable. I mean, I guess the only equivalent would be in the past. I mean, in several, you know, I guess Jack was reminding me last night that in Napoleon, when he went into Russia with his French troops, the Russians burned their own villages before Napoleon's troops could get there. That way the Russians would take away any sort of supply lines or resources that Napoleon's troops had. So I guess there are occasions when a military, an army will sort of burn things to try to make sure that they are denied to the invading forces. But for a private citizen, and a wealthy private citizen who's obviously got a lot to lose by having his own army bomb and destroy his estate, it's remarkable. And I think it goes right to how much the Ukrainians can't stand what Russia's doing to their country.
Yeah, 100%. Well, look, in the very early days of the invasion, we heard about the preemptive destruction of bridges, making it so that there were less areas, especially for Russian tanks to move into certain cities. You try to funnel them by destroying infrastructure. We know that that's fairly common. Sometimes in some of these areas, buildings were destroyed to create debris in the streets that would slow down the advance. And so these are tactics that you use. I just personally have never seen an individual civilian calling for it, which is a little bit odd. Other details though, I wanted to follow up. We talked last week about the new $800 million package of lethal aid, i.e. massive weapon systems that are being sent by the US to Ukraine, including things like long range artillery, like howitzers, literally hundreds of armored vehicles and helicopters. Well, there's been some debate over the past few days about whether Ukrainian soldiers would even be able to use some of this equipment, which Volodymyr Zelensky earlier this week answered, "We're plenty smart enough, we'll figure it out." Well, in addition to that, the Pentagon has now confirmed that US soldiers are going to be training Ukrainians on how to use those howitzers specifically. Although, and when I first saw that, I thought, oh dear God, is this the tipping point where our soldiers are moving in? Well, not technically, although it's going to be up to Vladimir Putin about whether this distinction matters. The training will not be taking place inside of Ukraine. The Ukrainian soldiers will be leaving the country, perhaps to somewhere like Poland or Romania, where equipment and weapons transfers have been conducted previously in this war. They will be trained there and then return inside of Ukraine. This is one of those wrinkles, David, where like we couldn't give them jets, that's too far. But apparently the artillery and helicopters, which are another type of aircraft, are allowed. And we can't man the howitzers, but we can give them the howitzers and train them and using them. It is bizarre what's allowed diplomatically and what's not.
Yeah, I mean, the line seems pretty flimsy to me. But you know, the thing about the Pentagon is the Pentagon has had these contingency plans apparently for months. And there's been all sorts of options that have been presented to the Secretary of Defense about here's how far we can go. And here's what we would do if we want to train on helicopters and planes. Here's how we would take the aircraft. Here's what we're going to do if it's howitzers and mortars. So clearly there's somebody at the Pentagon who's making the decision about where the line is and everything that's below the line. Okay, let's get the Ukrainian troops to Poland or nearby and let's have our troops who are there with all of the instruction manuals and everything in Ukrainian so that they know exactly, you know, what they're doing. The good thing about the howitzer is it's not the most complicated piece of military equipment. So that's something that there should be a pretty quick turnaround. But look, I mean, if you're, you know, Vladimir Putin, it's gonna drive you crazy, even if the United States is providing something small like a hand grenade and showing the Ukrainians how to pull the trigger.
Exactly, yeah. And he had been warning the US last week about this most recent package. I mean, this is, look, obviously having US soldiers there, that's a very clear line. It definitely feels like it's getting muddled. Obviously the Ukrainians need this equipment, they want it. They've been advocating for this for more than this. Just watching every day and hoping the US does not get pulled into this. And thus far, They've walked that line very carefully and it seems to have worked, but we're going to keep our eyes on it. Now, that said, we're going to transition to one of the most bizarre wrinkles in this story in some time. Take a look at this.
Well, as you know, I spent quite a bit of time here in the pre-war period. And when the invasion happened, I had friends who were in Donetsk, who were in the Ukrainian army, who were writing to us and telling us, we're not going to survive tonight. We've been hit 500 times. These are graduates of Defense Language Institute. These are my friends. And, you know, as the more I saw of the war going on, the more I thought, I'm done talking. All right. It's time to take action here.
So that came out this morning. That is Malcolm Nance, who's a contributor, previously was a contributor to MSNBC, who is now fighting in Ukraine for the Ukrainians. He tweeted, I'm done talking, with this sort of quasi promotional photo here. You can see there of him with his equipment. He gives a little bit more of his thought process in choosing to go fight in Ukraine in this video.
So about a month ago, I joined the International Legion here in Ukraine, and I am here to help this country fight, you know, what essentially is a war of extermination. This is an existential war, and Russia has bought it to these people, and they are mass murdering civilians. And there are people here like me who are here to do something about it.
So, David, of course, we know that there have been thousands of international volunteers to this effort, including Americans. This is one of the first times I've seen a former, basically, newsper, like a contributor who had prior experience with, intelligence and things like that. What do you make of this?
Well, first of all, even though it's not the kind of move that I would make, I give anybody great respect if you're going to walk the walk, talk the talk. I mean, this is how he feels strongly about it. Rather than just talk about this on TV and advocate for more involvement, he's going to put himself involved. So good for him. I'm not sure that Ukraine is quite as a principled war as some of the supporters of Ukraine like to point out. And by the way, I'd love to see some US analysts who would say, you know what? I'm going to volunteer to help, I don't know, maybe in Yemen, where the United States has been helping with the naval blockade of to try to keep the Iranian weapons from going in, but thereby also starving the Yemeni people. I mean, wars are complicated, and Ukraine also has its share of complications. But again, hats off to him, because he's not just sitting back on a TV and pontificating. He says this is important to me, and so he's doing it.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You know, a credit to the, for instance, activists, the people who work for nonprofits who do go to conflicts like Yemen. It's, you don't see the high profile stuff necessarily as much. That said, this is an incredibly dangerous thing to do. And, assuming everything is as it's being presented and seems, it is certainly courageous. He could be captured. He could die at any moment. At one point during that interview, they saw, I believe, cruise missiles fly by. Those could have hit his location. So that is certainly courageous. And you're right. Most will just pontificate. I will be taking that road, actually. I'm going to stay right here because I don't think I have much to contribute on the ground in Ukraine necessarily, nor is there a broad base asking for me to contribute in terms of arms. Look, if it starts polling well, I guess I'll be forced. For now, I'm going to do this. Anyway, more details on him. According to his author biography, Malcolm Nance is a globally recognized counterterrorism expert with decades of experience in US intelligence. By the way, he's apparently 60. So that is even more impressive, going to fight when you're 60. He says he was grateful to be here to fight against Russia. He says, I'm glad that I can help my friends and I don't have to hear them talk about how many kids were killed that day. We're going to try to put a stop to that. Bear in mind, Ned Price, State Department spokesperson, said just last month that US citizens traveling to Ukraine to fight against the Russians, quote, face significant risks, including the very real risk of capture or death.
I would just add that the risk also goes up if you're doing broadcast television interviews from Ukraine with a US network, because even though the technology is awfully complicated, there are people who can sort of decipher exactly where this broadcast is emanating from. So for Mr. Nance's safety sake, maybe just stick to, tweets and social media. Don't actually do the live broadcast, or maybe do them taped just in case anybody's figuring out your GPS.
Yeah, that is a very real potential threat. I'm glad that he also had a little bit more message discipline than like a Geraldo back during the invasion of Iraq, literally just saying where they were at. If Malcolm Nance is going to do follow-up interviews, some sort of like anonymous background. That's what I would suggest. Don't be specific for your own safety and the safety of the people you're fighting with. But anyway, so far seems responsible. It's not the choice that I am choosing to make, but I do respect it on a level. Yes. Anyway, with that said, we're gonna move into our first break. When we come back, if you're planning on traveling on a plane or a train or perhaps even an Uber, things are gonna be different than they have been for the past few years. We'll give you all the details after this. So with that, let's talk about some domestic COVID related changes, starting with this. You remember that guy? Why am I bringing that guy back up? Cause he won. Larry the Cable Guy there won. And all of the other people who freaked out over having to wear a mask on literally a tiny enclosed tube of shared air, they won. They freaked out. They verbally harassed people. They assaulted flight attendants and other passengers and made such a big stink about it that socially they won. Because now the mask mandate for transit, including airlines and trains, is gone. A federal judge ruled just yesterday that the Biden administration's mandate aboard planes, trains, buses, and other public transportation is done. They said it's unlawful. This is US District Judge Catherine Kimball Mazel for the Middle District of, Florida. Anyway, they called the policy unlawful and ruled that the CDC had overstepped its legal authority by imposing the mandate back in February of 2021. Specifically, she didn't like that they had classified it under sanitation. She said that the wearing a mask cleans nothing and quote, at most it traps virus droplets. And who cares to do that, David, during a pandemic? So it's gone.
And of course, Judge Mazel was put on the bench by Donald Trump. There is an upside to all of this, because now channeling Larry the Cable Guy, now we can really tell who really does have the whore mouth on the airplane. but in all seriousness, I just hope that from now on, look, people, I suppose you can make the argument that we're sort of well past the most dangerous part of the pandemic. And so maybe it was, we were erring on the side of caution by having everybody wear masks anyway on airplanes and buses when so many people are vaccinated and whatnot. However, we're now in this phase where I do hope that if I choose to wear a mask with my kids when we go flying to Florida this coming weekend, I don't want to hear any sort of shaming of, oh, why did I have that mask on, you stupid? I mean, no, we should all be respectful of one another and what our choices are. And my choices may be different from the person who I'm flying with, and that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. The issue, of course, is that the it's up to me crowd has been downing on people for wearing masks for literally years. And there is every reason to believe that when you take that trip, someone is going to yell at you, hey, show me your whore mouth, David. They just might. By the way,
and I might have to show them something else.
Exactly, perhaps. And that might not be covered with a mask. Okay, so according to the CDC, the average of daily new cases of COVID-19 infections has increased by 19% in the past 7 days. It's something like 40% over the past 2 weeks, by the way. 100% of these new cases coming from the Omicron variant. So look, we have been, I don't think that there is anyone like doing a show like this that has given you updated daily information about COVID more over the past couple of years than us. We do it when it's going up, we do it when it's going down. I have been talking about the fact that the death count, the average daily death count has been dropping, where in fact, for the first time in a very long time, below 500 deaths per day. And by the way, hospitalizations still trending down. Now, I have of course noticed that the percentage reduction has been gradually leveling off to close to zero. And in a time when the case count is going up, my fear is that we're a couple of weeks out of the possibility of those numbers going up. I hope not. In any event, we're in a good situation. We can agree to that. But we're also not out of this situation. And of all of the places, one would hope that the last stand of masks would be on a plane. But no, they got rid of it. And by the way, they got rid of it in the middle of flights. There's video going around of a pilot making the announcement so that people took off their mask in the middle of a flight. So people that got on there under one set of safety protocols landed with another one, which seems to me to be needless. I feel like you could be consistent for the remainder of that individual flight, but maybe I'm hysterical, I don't know.
Well, look, there's also the problem with even people who are wearing the masks who are complying. I mean, there are always the jackasses who, you know, have the mask down just above their lips and not covering their nose. And somehow they thought that, oh, well, we're being compliant, when no, you're really not. So, I mean, for all the people who have been sort of flaunting this, okay, yeah, it is a victory. You get to take the mask off completely. You don't have to pretend anymore. But let's just keep in mind, there's still some people who are going to be flying, who are going to be on trains and planes and buses, who still may be immunocompromised, who still may be vulnerable, who even if they've had the vaccine, they still may be going through, I don't know, cancer treatments. So
yeah,
if anybody thinks that they've been exposed or they're not feeling well, I would just hope that as respect to your fellow citizen, you would still do something to try to protect yourself from spreading whatever it is you have.
I agree. That should be a bare minimum, but America has for a long time been below the bare minimum. Few more fun details on both the policy, what corporations are doing, as well as the judge. So Mazel, the judge that overturned it, was chosen by Trump for a lifetime judicial appointment at the age of 33. The youngest judge selected, that is crazy young. She is gonna be around for a long time. Oh, by the way, she was also rated by the American Bar Association as not qualified to hold the position, but they weren't gonna let that stop them. They said since her admission to the bar, Ms. Mazel has not tried a case, civil or criminal, as lead or co-counsel. They also have a standard that you should have been practicing law for a minimum of 12 years. She had 5 years, so a little bit short there. But a lack of, you know, like respect or concern for the ABA was hardly the only change that the Trump administration made. In 2017, they also notified the ABA that they would no longer have access to background information on judicial candidates before their nominations. Of course, George W. Bush had done a similar thing. And I would say that is hardly a show of confidence for the candidates that you think providing background information would hurt more than help them. But that's what they did. Anyway, how are corporations responding to this? Well, Delta put out this message. We are relieved to see the US mask mandate lift to facilitate global travel now that COVID-19 has transitioned to an ordinary seasonal virus. Thank you for your support in complying with the federal mask mandate and keeping each other and our customers safe during the pandemic. It is an ordinary seasonal virus, according to Delta. By the way, Uber has announced they will no longer require masks for US riders and drivers. They have this tweet. You can now ride without a mask and use the front seat if you need to. While mask usage is still recommended, we've updated our COVID safety policies. Let's move forward safely together. But you don't get to say that your focus is on safety when you're announcing an end to the safety measures and saying, and by the way, get up as close to the driver as you want. Sit on their lap if that makes you comfortable. But anyway, yeah, no, it's on the planes. It's gonna be on the trains. The only place seemingly where masks are still required, we found out this morning, was on Air Force One. Biden will still be requiring it. But for the rest of us, David, it's just, cross your fingers. You can still wear your own, I guess, which was always true. They're like stressing that. It's still optional. Yeah, I could put cloth on my face before. You're not being like merciful in this.
Yeah, now we go back to everybody, look, hoping that the person next to you, the stranger next to you, doesn't have some dreadful disease that you're gonna get infected with. And you know, maybe that's the world that we all wanna live in, and maybe we just wanna take our chances. But I would argue that even if the death rate is only 400 to 500 a day, that's still 400 or 500 a day. And under normal circumstances, that would be a huge news story. So it's still out there. For some people, it is still deadly. And again, I just, you know, I hope people use their sort of common sense. And if, you know, if you're sick, if you've got symptoms, maybe you don't travel, or if you do travel, at least try to protect yourself and don't shame anybody who decides they want to wear a mask or a visor and protect themselves.
Exactly. That seems fair. And for everyone, just best wishes. I'm gonna be checking those numbers every day. Hope the inevitable doesn't happen again. We'll see. I, more than anyone else, want things to go back to normal. I just don't want us to pretend that they're back to normal before they're back to normal. let's switch up our gears and talk about something completely different. Candidate J.D. Vance was recently endorsed by Donald Trump, but I have to wonder if that endorsement is going to remain after Trump realizes that J.D. Vance speculated that Trump might be America's Hitler. First, the endorsement, which happened just April 15th, this is 4 days ago, where Trump said, like some others, J.D. Vance may have said some not so great things about me in the past, but he gets it now, and I've seen that in spades. He is our best chance for victory in what could be a very tough race. The Democrats will be spending many millions of dollars, but the good news is that they have a defective candidate who ran for president and garnered exactly 0% in the polls. The bottom line is we must have a Republican victory in Ohio. And by the way, he points out that the MAGA movement, which he calls the greatest in the history of our country, it's only like the second Make America Great Again movement, so there's not that much competition. Anyway, he says he will put America first. In other words, J.D. Vance has my complete and total endorsement. And by the way, before the update about America's Hitler, which we'll give you the details on, came out, Trump was already receiving a great deal of pushback for choosing J.D. Vance rather than some of the more like preferred by the establishment candidates in that race. He apparently stopped taking phone calls after making the endorsement because so many Republicans were calling him to complain and ask him to backtrack. They preemptively had been asking for him to, at the very least, don't endorse anyone. Let us figure it out. But David, he weighed in, and now it's going to be J.D. Vance, at least as far as Trump is concerned.
And this is one of the most interesting races, I think, of any sort of primary battle, because it's a very competitive GOP primary. J.D. Vance is not the front runner. There is no clear front runner. And so this is also a race where, I mean, Trump alluded to, well, you know, the Democratic challenger, Tim Ryan, he's actually seen as fairly formidable and somebody who's got a pretty good chance of picking up the Senate seat from the retiring Rob Portman. So Donald Trump's endorsement here, if it falls flat and J.D. Vance does not win, that will speak volumes. And again, I think each of these Republican candidates is fairly flawed. And Donald Trump identified some of the flaws, like with Mandel, who had a terrible debate, literally wanted to fight somebody on the stage. And apparently that's what caused Donald Trump to decide, no, I don't like the way this guy appears on TV, so I'm gonna not endorse him. Well, that's kind of a strange way of doling out endorsements, but this is a winnable seat for Democrats in a year when the headwinds are really against them.
Yeah, it totally could be. And we're gonna have to see if the Republicans have this predisposition over the past couple of cycles to lose some races that they could have won by choosing absolute wackos. And we'll see if this is a bridge too far. And if the eventual Democratic candidate, by the way, we had Morgan Harper on the show last week. We'll see. I hope that the Democrats bring it. But I want to give you the details. So what's the new wrinkle to this? Well, J.D. Vance apparently used to be roommates with Josh McLaurin, who shared a 2016 text message, a screenshot of it, from J.D. Vance. And we're gonna read some of it. This is J.D. Vance supposedly saying, but I'm not surprised by Trump's rise, and I think the entire party has only itself to blame. We are, whether we like it or not, the party of lower income, lower education white people. And I've been saying for a long time that we need to offer those people something, and hell, maybe even expand our appeal to working class black people in the process, or a demagogue would. We are now at that point. Trump is the fruit of the party's collective neglect. I go back and forth between thinking Trump is a cynical a-hole like Nixon, who wouldn't be that bad or might even prove useful, or that he's America's Hitler. How's that for discouraging? That is fairly discouraging. Maybe not as discouraging as having an author like J.D. Vance being perfectly able to diagnose all of this in 2016 and in the span of just a few years decide, yeah, maybe that is the path that we're going down, and maybe it is horrifying, and maybe I can jump in it, and I can be one of the candidates that rides this to fame and fortune. And that looks like what he's done. Assuming this is authentic, and so far there's been nothing that's come out that proves that it's not, it looks like he was worried. He had every reason to be worried. And that was before, David, that was before the 4 years of Trump, before the insurrection and the attempt to end American democracy. And now he's got no problem with Trump.
And he also has no principles, right? Because look, I guess you expect now politicians will sort of constantly sort of put their finger in the wind to decide which way it's blowing. But you'd like to think that at least some Republican out there would say, okay, yeah, Donald Trump was troubled back in 2016 and my position hasn't changed. And I guess at least, you know, there's Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney and a couple others, but J.D. Vance, I mean, he had Trump pegged. He had it exactly right in 2016. And I would argue that, you know, Trump has only made the case even stronger for what J.D. Vance is saying. But now J.D. Vance is deciding, well, as far as my own seeking power and having some authority and some prestige, that's okay. I can just sort of swallow Donald Trump, no problem. And it's embarrassing. And I just wish these people would somehow realize how little self-respect they seem to have.
Exactly. Yeah. And if I was a regular conservative, that you might like J.D. Vance. You might like his recent ad where he's like, are you a racist? Do you hate Mexicans? They pretend that we're right. So you get, he diagnosed all of what the right was doing to bamboozle their fans. He was saying at that point, no, we need to actually offer them something. We can't just be demagogues. Well, what is he doing with his race now that he's a candidate? Is he charting a new path focused on substance, focusing on economics, on righting all of these historic wrongs? No, he's a demagogue. He identified it and now he's doing it. It's up to you, Republicans, on whether you're gonna actually be willingly conned by it. Anyway, with that said, we do have to get to our second break. When we come back though, an update on Biden, an update on the possibility of student loan debt cancellation and more after this. Okay, everybody, let's jump into some maybe hopeful, optimistic news. Take a look at this.
Is the president taking executive action to cancel a level of student debt still on the table? And yeah. Like, when is that gonna?
Yes, still on the table, still on the table. So just to play out what Ron Klain was talking about. So as you said, it ends August 31st. We have to then decide whether it's extended. And what you look at is, even though the economy is very strong, we created more jobs last year than any year in history. Sure. Even though that's the case, we know, as we've been talking about, costs are too high, and certainly not having to pay back student loans. Nobody's had to pay a dollar, a cent, anything in student loans since Joe Biden's been president. And if that can help people ease the burden of costs in other parts of their life, that's an important thing to consider. That's a big part of the consideration. So between now and August 31st, it's either going to be extended or we're going to make a decision, as Ron referenced, about canceling student debt.
Okay, so that was Jen Psaki on a recent live taping of the Pod Save America podcast. And she decided to give us hope, I guess. Yes, it could still happen, and it could happen relatively recently. They're gonna make some sort of decision before August. There was caveats there. There was some framing to the topic that I don't necessarily like, David, but Jen Psaki does imply that there is still a chance that cancellation as well as an extension could happen before the election. What do you think?
Well, to use a sports analogy, this is a basketball layup. This is a gimme putt. I mean, this is a no-brainer if you're looking at where Joe Biden is politically. It would be huge for students. He could time it out in August when people are going back to college campuses at the end of the summer and get a lot of play out of it. And there's no reason not to, right? I mean, our government has given so many breaks to so many corporations and so many wealthy people. We have been investing in our younger people when you give them student loans, interest-free student loans and whatnot. This would be related to that. And it just for so many reasons. And also because Joe Biden, you know, this is a key plank for progressives. And if Joe Biden wants to try to improve his relationship with the Democratic base, he has to do this.
Yeah, I agree. Well, look, I have a problem with what I heard in that video, and I am hoping that you will be able to tell me how I'm wrong. You have more experience than me, more knowledge than me, and we're gonna see if I'm naive or wrong here. So she says it could happen, but she says now, and this is just repeating what Biden has said. This isn't anything new from Jen Psaki. She says, but he'd prefer for it to come through legislation that makes it more permanent. And you know, at least one of the Pod Save America guys agreed with that framing. An executive order isn't as permanent as legislation would be. And I don't like that framing at all, especially on this topic. Because for me, what does it mean to say that it's more permanent? Once he cancels it, what's the idea that either politically or in terms of law, the Republicans would come back into power and they'd return the debt? I don't even know legally how that would work, but let's say they were to. Would that be potentially the most unpopular political move ever made by a modern political party? That people who had been relieved of debt perhaps for 6 months, for a year, for 2 years at that point, would suddenly have tens of thousands of dollars of debt thrown onto them by the incoming political party? That to me just seems so inconceivable that I can't believe that they believe it. And so it leaves me to think, no, that's weaseling out of it. That's implying, well, we're saying we could do it, but we really don't want to. So this is sort of cover. I don't know. Does any of that make sense? What do you think?
No, it does make sense. And that's a fair criticism and a great analysis of where the situation stands and how it would play out politically if, in fact, they rescinded it through an executive order. They would never go back. But I think my sense and my take on this is that Joe Biden has always preferred to do things through, you know, the legislative process. He's not closing the door to an executive order, but I got the sense that Jen Psaki didn't want to get out ahead of Joe Biden, get herself in trouble by saying, oh, yeah, you know, we might definitely do this by executive order. She's sort of couching it in a way so that if Joe Biden happens to watch this, he is still the one who's making the decision. And he may for now say, let's give it a few more months and see what we can do legislatively before ultimately I have to decide whether in fact we're going to do it through an executive order. And that's my sense, just Jen Psaki not wanting to get out in front of her skis.
Okay, that's interesting. I appreciate that. But maybe I shouldn't get out in front of my skis too. Anyway,
no, but it's a valid concern. And if there's a chance that Joe Biden is going to say, if we can't get it done legislatively, then we're not going to do it. If there's even a chance that he might do that, that would be horrible. And it's worth pointing that out right now and putting out, you know, all the flags and everything out on all the warning signals to people that, okay, if Joe Biden still thinks there's a possibility he might not do this because he can't get it done legislatively, wow.
Yeah. Okay, fast little bit of breaking news. Breaking dramatic domestic political news. Joe Biden will apparently be running for re-election. That is according to The Hill, who says that Biden has told former President Obama that he is planning to run for re-election in 2024. Two sources familiar with the conversations apparently confirm that, saying Biden wants to run and he's clearly letting everyone know. By the way, back in Brussels at a press conference just last month, he told reporters he'd be very fortunate to run against Donald Trump in the 2020 election. I think that's up for debate about whether it would be good to have that rematch. But the source also said, by the way, not only is he going to be running again, but Biden, despite his faltering approval ratings, I would say they have plummeted to about half of what they were, remains the most likely Democratic candidate to defeat Donald Trump. By the way, were he to win, he would be 82 years old at the beginning of his second term. David, what do you think about this? You think he's going to run?
I think it's smart for him to indicate to everybody that he's planning to do it, barring some sort of health issue or catastrophe. And look, Democrats have a lot of, you know, there's been so much hand-wringing over, the Democrats are going to lose 40 or 50 House seats. And yeah, they probably will. But Barack Obama lost, you know, a lot of House seats and lost control of the House of Republicans. And he still, 2 years later, won a second term. Bill Clinton, the same thing happened. He lost a lot of House seats, lost control in 1994. The Republicans took over and Bill Clinton won re-election in 96. So just because the Democrats are in such bad shape right now and things look so terrible, and they might be terrible on election night, sometimes it has a way of changing the political pivot and sometimes focusing a president on, okay, now it's the Republicans' responsibility for helping to get things done. And when Republicans decide to continue blocking everything, that could conceivably help Joe Biden's political position going into 2024.
So I agree with you. I think that is an accurate read of what might happen. My fear is them being okay with that, with not just having that as like, well, you know, worst case scenario, we might not lose the presidency. Like, I don't know, like the Democrats seem to really be comfortable running against the Republicans of being the ones that are going to take things back. Like, but you're in power. I want you to do something when you're in power. Like, and if you could make it 30 rather than 50 or 15 rather than 30, there are policy ways you could do that, including the aforementioned student loan debt cancellation potentially. So I agree. And as you know, as commentators, we need to get our audience ready by letting them know historically how these things tend to shake out. But I hope that they do something. By the way, we talked about the faltering approval ratings. So this is a collapse in support from since 2021. January. So basically the first year and a half of his presidency. People who are 18 to 34. His approval rating is down 19 points. No college, 20 points. Hispanic, 26 points. Black, 30 points. That is 14, 15 months, David. That is a big drop in support in some discrete groups there.
No, I agree. And look, these are terrible circumstances for an incumbent president, regardless whether it's Joe Biden or anybody else. I mean, think about it. We're already talking because of Ukraine about the possibility of a nuclear conflagration with Russia. That's something we haven't spoken about in a long time. The economy, as well as the economy is doing, yes, prices are going much higher. And then, oh, by the way, we're still incinerating our planet because we're not doing anything about greenhouse gases and climate change. So if you're a younger person, you're concerned about the future 50 or 60 years out, you think, oh my God, things are only going to get worse. And if you think things are only going to get worse over the next several decades, you're going to be infuriated at the people who are in office now who are not doing anything. And so at a certain point, Joe Biden has to break through and has to say, here's something we are concrete doing, whether it's for sure raising the minimum wage or tackling climate change or doing something that people can point to heading into 2024 and saying, aha, I see what Joe Biden has done to turn things around.
I think you're 100% right. And I hope they're listening to that. Okay, with that said, let's move into our last topic of the hour, and it's actually a spicy one. So let's jump into this. You probably already know by now that just about 6 months after leaving the White House, Jared Kushner used his connections prior and potentially in the future to get about $2 billion worth of investment capital from the Saudis. Despite the fact, as was reported, the panel that is supposed to evaluate the Saudi investments looked into Jared Kushner and his new affinity capital group and decided this is a terrible deal. They don't have experience. We shouldn't do this. So they said no, but Mohammed bin Salman said, no, we're doing this. I like Jared. I like where he's going. We're doing this. And now new PowerPoint documents of their pitch have come out that show it to be even more of a joke than we thought initially. So, oh, by the way, let me also throw in that the Saudi Investment Fund Group said that the deal was, quote, to form a strategic relationship with Kushner rather than on the basis of its financial merit. We already know that. We knew what this was about. It's just, it's a $2 billion investment of a certain type. But anyway, Affinity Partners was very clear about that you should not be investing because they necessarily know what they're doing, but they know certain people. And you'll see that quickly. First of all, here is one of their slides. This was obtained, by the way, by Kenny Klippenstein, a friend of the show over at The Intercept. Affinity Partners, very cool logo there, Jared. Anyway, he says, our unique network and experience makes us a differentiated partner for companies navigating the rapidly evolving global political and economic environment. That strikes me as a person who needed to do their PowerPoint really quickly and busted out the thesaurus and added in a bunch of buzzwords that they neither understand nor can deploy accurately. They say our unique experience and perspective allows us to tie macro and government policy trends to economic themes and investment opportunities, which is a pitch designed to cause your brain to run out of your ears and down your neck. But the joke's on me because it apparently worked. Now we're going to get to more of these slides, but what do you make about this recent investment move by Jared Kushner?
It makes me want to throw up. I mean, as somebody who has actually put together these slides and sought out angel investors and money for different projects, I mean, you have to have if you're one of us, you have to have a clear product and you have to have a clear plan about how you're going to make some money and how this is going to be successful. If you're Jared Kushner, all you have to do is say, oh yeah, my father-in-law is the president. And oh, by the way, I'm chums with the Saudi crown prince. That's all it takes. And suddenly he's going to get $25 million a year in management fees for this investment. I mean, it makes me want to throw up.
100%. And look, he is hardly the first person that has used their connections, especially after leaving the White House, to do this. The thing that makes him noteworthy is that it is such a cartoonishly transparent version of it. Like, they know who you are, dude. You don't, in the PowerPoint, need to be like, hey, by the way, did you know that we know all these people? Yes, they get it. That's the only reason they're talking in the first place. But he is, they love to pretend that he's this like wunderkind or whatever, but he doesn't even understand how corruption is supposed to be done. In any event, he does multiple slides about how awesome he is and the people he knows. I'm not going to go through all of this. Noteworthy fact, though, in addition to Jared Kushner, one of the people involved in this investment thing is married to the judge who we talked about earlier on the show that just struck down the transportation mask mandate. So, you know, small world. One might call it a deep state. Anyway, we're moving on. The slides make repeated reference to Affinity's network, which includes a bunch of Trump administration appointees in the team members section. They say that we're going to accelerate transformation through connectivity, which sounds like something Elizabeth Holmes would have said during a pitch. It's just so buffoonish. But the only thing more ridiculous perhaps is that the mainstream media really didn't talk much about this. They are focused on the Hunter Biden thing. That is the issue of people with political connections getting money from international sources that we should be worried about, not these billions of dollars for Jared Kushner.
And you've just explained what connectivity really means when Jared Kushner articulates it. It's baffling. And And again, I just, you know, Jared Kushner better hope that his father-in-law now runs for president, because the moment his dad says, oh no, I'm not running in 2024, forget about any more investments like this.
Yeah, it'll be done. Okay, thank you everyone for listening. If you're on YouTube or Twitch, we do have more planned. We're gonna take a quick couple minute break, but we got some awesome stories for you after this.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.